Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a few minutes. Hello, my name is Paul Bierman, Director of Education and Events for SNEB. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior Journal Club webinar, part of a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition education programs and implications from the field. A special thank you to the SNEB Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for helping select articles from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few pieces of information with you. We will take questions throughout the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the questions box, and they will be moderated out to our panelists towards the end. When the webinar ends today, you will be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete that survey, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members under the webinar section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I will now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, Teaching Assistant Professor at the University of Illinois. Kristen?
Thank you, Paul. Today, our speakers are Patrick Brady and Kelly Kunkel. Dr. Patrick Brady is a mixed methods food and nutrition security researcher and evaluator. He is motivated by the fundamental right for all peoples and communities to have access to quality and preferable foods. He is especially interested in food and nutrition security at the intersection of aging and rurality. Kelly Kunkel is an extension educator with the University of Minnesota Extension Department of Family, Health, and Well-Being, working out of the Mankato Regional Office. She has extensive experience working in the community, implementing nutrition education and systems supports for food pantries. I want to thank them both for joining us, and at this point, I can hand the presentation over to our speakers.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. Can everybody see my slides? Are those up? Okay, I see some nodding. Great. So again, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll just get started. Here are the competencies we will be covering in this presentation. You can refer back to these, and also there's a complete list available online. We have no actual or potential conflicts of interest to declare. And we also want to acknowledge the funding that led to this work. Before we start any presentation, we also take a brief moment to acknowledge our position in society and really focus that this social and political context that we exist in will influence how we interpret and conduct our work. We study these topics because we believe there is an obligation to ensure adequate access to food in all dimensions. And we welcome feedback and constructive criticism to help us grow as researchers and advocates. To give a bit of a roadmap for what we're going to talk about today, I'm going to spend a little bit of time going over some backgrounds and definitions just to make sure everybody's on the same page. Then we'll go into some methods and results from our study. And we'll also spend some time talking about the continuation of this research after the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then we'll give conclusions and discuss some implications as it relates to nutrition education. So to get us all on the same page, we just want to take a little bit of time going over some background and some definitions. And to start, just by defining what is food security. And we use the USDA definition, where food security is consistent access to enough food for every person in a household to live an active, healthy life. And food security is well established as a social determinant of health. Experiencing food insecurity has many negative health and social consequences. And, you know, there's a lot of work that has been put into establishing that having that healthy diet and access to sufficient food is really beneficial. But one of the major limitations with food insecurity is because of the way we've measured it, we've really focused on economic access to enough food at the household level. So that's where nutrition security as a concept comes in. So it's relatively recent, but it's really important and emerging factor that we really expanding how we think about inadequate food access. So nutrition security highlights the quality of the foods that are available, saying they need to promote well-being, prevent disease, and if needed, treat disease. It also highlights adequate access along multiple dimensions. So it's not just economic access. It's also, are there foods available? Are they affordable? So it includes that economic dimension, but it expands it. And it also specifically names underserved and marginalized populations. So it has a stronger focus on the distribution of inadequate food access in society. And that's something we're really concerned at. Just to give a brief example, we know that food insecurity rates differ by characteristics. There was a very recent report that highlighted differences by race and ethnicity that came out a couple days ago. But here we just have some examples. If we look at all households, it's about 13%. But if we get into thinking about who's in that household, households with children have much higher rates, while households with an older adult generally have lower rates. But then there's contextual factors that can affect risk of experiencing food insecurity. So if you're an older adult living alone, it looks a lot more like the general population than the overall population of older adults. And it also varies geographically, which is one of our main concerns. So if you're in either a principal city or in a rural area outside of those metro regions, you have an elevated risk compared to people who are in metro areas but outside of that principal city. So we know food insecurity is a problem. We know it's unequally distributed in society. We know there's a lot of work we can do to fix it. So how do we go about doing that? And in the United States, we really have two major avenues. The first one, which we're not going to discuss a lot today, but it's really important to always kind of keep this in mind, are our government food assistance programs. These are really the backbone of the nutrition safety net in the United States, and they're very effective at reducing food insecurity. But there are some limitations associated with these programs. First, they're underused due to stigma and things like administrative burden. They're exclusionary, often by design. So people with slightly too high incomes or people who have been formerly incarcerated may not be able to access these services. And in their current form, they're also insufficient to eliminate food insecurity. So despite being effective at reducing, they just simply don't offer the level of benefits required to eliminate food insecurity among program participants. And that's where the other part of our nutrition safety net comes in, the emergency food system. So this is a resource for households that are either underserved or ineligible for other forms of assistance. And it's a really important part in the United States. You may also know this as the food banking system, the charitable food system, or the private food assistance network. It goes by a lot of names. It looks really different from community to community. But when we think about it broadly, we like to say it's, a system or network of nonprofit organizations that source and distribute surplus commodity and purchase foods at low or no cost. And I think this definition is important because it highlights the types of foods they're distributing. It's not all donations. They're also serving government programs, those commodity food programs. They're really the community-facing organizations who distribute those. And a lot of emergency food providers purchase foods because they just simply need to fill in their supply. And especially for some of those healthier items, they're not receiving those, so they are forced to purchase them. The emergency food system is also really interesting because there's a lot of interaction with other organizations and services. So it can really be a hub for connecting people with resources. And while it's very beneficial for those receiving food, there are challenges associated with the emergency food system. The first is that it was really designed to meet short-term need while at the same time cutting down on food waste. That was how it was originally conceived, really as a stopgap measure in our nutrition safety net before we could pass people off to those more effective and established government programs. But that's not how it's really working. It's now often serving chronic need. People rely on this for a major part of their total household food supply. There often have been long running concerns over the nutritional quality of foods in the food system. I think it's a little, we need to consider this emergency food system also exists within our wider food system that is abundant with calorie dense and nutrient poor foods. And we really shouldn't expect the emergency food system to be able to overcome that challenge, especially with some of the other barriers they face. And I will say that there has been recently a lot of movement towards making the health, the food supply and the emergency food system healthier and more culturally appropriate. Another challenge we often encounter when we're talking with emergency food providers is just the stigma their clients face when they're receiving emergency food. Receiving any type of support is heavily stigmatized in the United States, and especially emergency food because it has that charitable aspect to it. People often are hesitant to access these resources. Emergency food providers also lack resources themselves. This often is funding, but it can also be things like infrastructure. So having a physical space or having things like refrigerator or freezers adequate to supply all their community members. There's also a lack of kind of people. So either staff or volunteers that are an incredibly important resource. So distributing this food is really labor intensive. And if you don't have enough people, it can be quite challenging. And then finally, from more academic perspective, the body of research in the emergency food system has really focused on users with less information or perspectives from providers, and also in urban communities, and there's less information on rural communities. So if you're working in those rural communities with emergency food providers, especially at this intersection, there's not a lot of information on their experiences and their perspectives. So I'll hand it off to Kelly and she'll go over our study that tried to address that concern.
Thank you, Patrick. Here you see the goals and the research questions for our study. We wanted to better understand the perspectives of emergency food providers and their partners and their shoppers. And we call our food shelf clients shoppers in rural communities to enhance the work the University of Minnesota Extension does with the state's food shelves. The questions we posed: what practices and resources are better used to serve rural communities? And what are the barriers and challenges to providing services in rural areas? So now let's look at the methods. Our methods included data. The data was collected as part of an evaluation of the University of Minnesota Extension's work with rural food shelves. We extensively work with food shelves across the state of Minnesota. And we work with partners in the emergency food system setup, and we set up focus groups discussion, and we allowed the food shelf managers to select who they thought would provide the most valuable insight. They know the people that they serve, they know the volunteers that they have, and so we thought that they would be the best to select who they felt would have that insight. The extension staff conducted 5 in-person focus group discussions, 37 total participants. I might mention that 7 were planned, but because those were planned, the last 2 were planned during COVID, those 2 didn't happen, but we would have had a larger participation number. Then the information was recorded, all of the focus groups were recorded and transcribed, and they were analyzed using thematic analysis. So let's take a look at some of the strengths and innovations that we found in our study. One of the things we found is that the food shelves were very passionate about offering healthier and fresh foods. Their clients, their shoppers were asking for that as well. So here you see some of the things, the quotes that we heard during those focus groups that were recorded. One thing that we have worked hard at is to provide more fresh produce. And so we work with 2 stores on rescue, a gas station and a grocery store. And we go to them 3 times a week for fresh produce. And we get soft bread from a grocery store. And we've obviously increased on our produce tremendously. We've cut back on our boxed and our canned meals, and which gave lots of people some anxiety and sadness at first. People are happier with it now. The next thing we look at is just that innovation in models for serving clients. One quote said, including the delivery and the mobile food pantries. One quote, we have a fairly good sized group of older adult shoppers. Luckily, there's a person and her daughter who are doing the deliveries for us. Using client choice models or shopping models, it's nice offering client choice models if you have facilities that has the space to do it. It doesn't make a huge difference because if you didn't ever have a choice, and it looks more like a store than a food shelf, that makes a difference. Our next is connecting within the communities, and we looked at integrating with broader community resources. Our caseworkers offer some budgeting classes. She offers some cooking classes. She offers some gardening classes and general household maintenance and household keeping. Those types of things. Another theme that came quite strongly is that people are valued. It wasn't an inviting place. There was one guy that was quite an with that, that had quite an attitude. If he didn't like you, you didn't get whatever he decided to throw on. You'd get whatever he decided to throw in a bag. Now everyone that comes through the door is treated with great respect and loving open arms. Nobody's judged, and that's wonderful. Some of the results and the results, the gaps and challenges, we found that transportation was a barrier, especially in greater Minnesota or rural Minnesota. We have 9 cities in this county, and we have a food shelf. We have food shelves at 2. It might not be possible for others to make it. Our goal for 2020 is to figure out a mobile food shelf and to get out to those people. Organizational barriers were also a situation, a problem. We are open 5 days a week, but we're not open all day, and there's not enough variety in our hours. And then we found stigma to be a barrier to food access. One comment, that's a tough one. How to get hesitant groups to use the food pantry? Maybe if we had a private setting so that no one would see them, the shoppers. Continuing with the barriers, we saw limitations to information access. So one comment stated, we're seeing a larger Hispanic population coming to church, but few of them come to the food shelf. There's a language barrier. It is a little tough since I'm not bilingual and we don't have anything Spanish materials up. And then we saw public policy and economic barriers. We get a lot of people saying they cut my food stamps, but they just can't make it anymore. We also saw some themes in changing demographics. As we get more people that are of the retirement age, we're going to see an increase because the system is only built for so much and we're already bursting at the seams. Baby boomers are the largest generation. And another comment, I can tell you that when the staff is gone for the day, I struggle with the communication piece. So we're really lucky. There aren't many food shelves that have someone who's bilingual. So that has really helped to increase the number of people that we are able to serve because there was a demographic that we couldn't serve before. Looking at the needs of the food pantry, the appropriate and sustainable food supply. So one comment was the super center is closing. That if the super center closing, that would be really devastating. We would lose almost 75% of our produce as a result of food donations from that food center. The food pantry shopper need additional non-food support. So a comment, clients that come through have asks or needs around resources like SNAP, public health, a dentist, healthcare, and many asked, but we don't think we have the ability or the capacity. Additional financial, physical, labor, and technology capacities as a need at the food shelf. One comment, we would definitely need donations, just not just the in-kind stuff, but time and talent. Those are things that will make this work. We need volunteers. That's the lifeblood of what makes our food shelf work. Now I'm going to turn it over to Patrick, and he's going to talk about extending this work.
Yeah, so as Kelly kind of mentioned, these focus groups were planned right at the end of 2020 or 2019 and going into 2020. So they kind of had to abruptly stop as the COVID-19 pandemic emerged. And really the emergency food system had to kick into high gear in order to meet need. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar or remember the news stories about these giant distributions, organizations trying to figure out how to do things differently and how to do things safely, but still meet that, you know, really expected increase in food need that we saw due to massive unemployment and social disruption. So we conducted a pretty similar study to the focus groups, and the goal was also pretty similar, but we wanted to examine the experiences of partners in statewide, regional, and local roles, rural providers, as well as shoppers age 60 and older, again, in Minnesota's emergency food system, in the context of the pandemic, with a focus on rural communities. So again, we worked with our partners in the School of Public Health and Extension again to connect with those relevant partners. One of the managers who we had worked with in this first study participated in our second, in addition to four other managers at other food shelves. And this time we did in-depth telephone interviews, so they were one-on-one. We didn't have that interaction between stakeholders, but we thought this was the most feasible way to get some really strong answers. And, you know, we had a real wide variety of partners. So at the state and regional level, we wanted that broad perspective. So we talked to staff from anti-hunger advocacy groups, people in the government whose work was directly relevant or with the food shelves and food pantries, and then food bank staff. So really getting more of that distribution view instead of just really engaging with the clients and serving the community. And then we wanted to bring in Extension themselves. So we actually interviewed some of our Extension SNAP Ed educators because we know their work with food shelves had to pivot as well. To get that rural perspective, we focused on rural emergency food providers. And then I have an interest in older adults. So when we were talking to our shoppers, I focused on those shoppers who are age 60 and older. We also used rapid qualitative analysis as our method, template analysis, where instead of going through a thematic analysis and coding line by line, you as a researcher and a practitioner are actually summarizing the results within an interview, putting in a template, and then looking at your summaries to develop those themes. So it's very similar, but we were really excited about this method because it enabled us to really quickly develop an overall perspective and then also take that back to our community partners and say, is this reflective of your experience? Is this accurate? Are we missing anything in our summaries after talking to all these people? So right now, this is under review. Hopefully it will be published soon, but we wanted to just briefly present it because we think it reflects a lot of what we were hearing before in the focus groups. And in some cases, we think things have actually maybe improved somewhat over the pandemic, not because of the pandemic, but because of the large infusion of especially financial resources. Emergency food providers really were able to expand their services and provide food, which was a large concern prior to the pandemic. One of the things we saw again reflected in 2019, then again here, is that shoppers really value the support that's provided by the emergency food system. There's a good quantity of food available. The health is improving. There's still some concerns with food quality and nutritional content, but you know, it's improving, it's getting better. And you know, they're really appreciative of that food support. We also heard again that, you know, food shelves are really making an effort to be warm and welcoming. Like you saw in the quote from the one individual in the focus groups, you know, everybody's respected here. And we again heard this from both our providers and our shoppers. But that doesn't mean stigma still doesn't exist, and especially coming from more outside sources, so not necessarily the emergency food providers who are putting a lot of effort into reducing that stigma, but coming from other sources. So it's still going to be a major barrier for a lot of folks, and just changing the internal attitudes of the emergency food system and the staff and volunteers within it is going to be insufficient for dealing with this stigma. I always do like to highlight that even though I like focusing on other dimensions of access besides economic, in our food system and in our country, the main barrier to food and nutrition security with how we have things set up is always going to be financial accessibility. We don't have that adequate nutrition safety net where everybody either has enough in-kind food or cash assistance support to enable them to consume a healthy diet. Even if you gave everybody enough money, I still believe we'd have some barriers. But if everybody had enough money to buy healthy food, that would be a pretty good start towards taking care of some of these concerns. And then one thing we actually saw really become more of a concern, I think, is with the volunteer and the labor capacity. In 2019, it was a concern. They were saying, we need more volunteers. They're their lifeblood. The main issue is that many volunteers in the emergency food system are older folks and retired folks, often with dealing with complex health issues. And because of the COVID-19 pandemic, for safety reason, a lot of people opted out. They said, you know, personally, it's not worth the risk. I can't justify, I wish I could, but just cannot justify doing this activity anymore. Where you are, you're exposed to a lot of people. And when we have a respiratory infection going around, it is quite risky. But you never, the food shelves never really recovered their volunteer base. So really trying to figure out how we can connect emergency food providers to additional volunteers, how we can educate our communities that this is a service and a really fruitful thing they could be doing with their time volunteering in this system. I think we have a lot of opportunities there. And then finally, kind of our main, to me, most important finding is that the need is increasing and the support is keeping up. We actually, from kind of a food security and nutrition security perspective, all of the support that was available during the COVID-19 pandemic really helped ensure people were able to access enough food. This includes support going to households, so expanded SNAP benefits, direct stimulus payments, things like the enhanced child tax credit. All those did a lot to support households' food security. And if you look at some of the spending patterns, a lot of people spent quite a bit of that money, even though it was not directly provided for food, on ensuring they could eat a healthy diet. At the same time, we were also supporting our emergency food system to a greater extent. So there was ample funding going to those providers. There was money for them to make infrastructure improvements and do things like purchase vehicles to enable home delivery or trucks to set up a mobile food pantry. They really had this money around and the resources to execute their mission. That was all temporary, though. We didn't set up a sustainable way where we were going to continue funding this and making sure that those emergency food providers can really serve all the members of the community. And at the same time, especially once inflation started kicking in, we saw a huge uptick in food insecurity and also people accessing food shelves. In Minnesota, I believe this past year, the latest year we have data, was the highest number ever for food shelf visits. And another thing we heard in this interview is that previously hesitant groups are now at that level of need where they're accessing the system. So the stigma, the avoidance that people felt before that kept them from, the financial constraints and lack of food is so bad that it's overcoming those barriers, which is really concerning. You know, we want to eliminate those barriers, but we don't want the need of our community members to be the driving force to make those things not salient. So moving forward, I think we should focus on learning from the pandemic and really understanding what were those opportunities that were there through that temporary support, and how did we better support our community members. So I'm going to pass it back now to Kelly to wrap up with our conclusions and kind of our implications for nutrition educators.
Thank you, Patrick. And as you're thinking about any questions that you might have, please be sure to put those in the chat. We'll have time at the end of our presentation to address those questions. But some of our key takeaways, as we saw through this study, as through both studies, that there's a systemic systemic and structural barriers to access are prevalent in the emergency food system, and they may be exacerbated by rural communities. That the emergency food resources are a critical part of the nutrition food safety network in rural communities. And assets include social connections within rural contexts. And while we look at social connections, we can look at those connections between partners, as well as the social connections for our shoppers and our volunteers as well. The flexibility to implement innovations, the dedication to improve the quality, nutritional quality of foods and services with dignity, that came overwhelmingly in all of the work that we've done. Some of the implications and the opportunities for nutrition educators. We know that the emergency food system offers many opportunities to improve nutrition knowledge and food intake. There are some opportunities for doing that nutrition education, cooking demonstrations, taste testing, and that and to just help to improve the overall health. To need to understand the regional and local context to effectively work with community-based providers. Patrick mentioned earlier that things can be so different from community to community with regard to emergency food systems, and so getting to understand those regional and local context. And then to need to a need to assess local capacity, and if lacking, implement interventions to increase capacity before implementing efforts to provide nutrition education and dietary intake. So all of these are implications and opportunities for our nutrition educators. I'm going to turn it back over to Patrick so that he can kind of wrap things up, and then ask for questions, comments, and thoughts.
Yeah, we'd be happy to take any questions, comments, thoughts. I see there's a couple in the QA already.
Thank you so much. There are a few questions coming in. As people have more questions, please put those in the Q&A box. So the first question is, did you by chance find any families who go hungry for their children?
So I will say in the two qualitative studies we put here, no, that doesn't mean it isn't happening, but it didn't emerge in the focus groups. And specifically in the post-COVID study, we were talking mainly to older adults. So we did not observe that. I will say that it's extremely common among food insecure individuals adults in the household to be experiencing food insecurity, but insulating their children from that. And we don't have the specific data right here to say that, yes, we heard that, but I would highly suspect families that are accessing these food shelves in rural Minnesota are insulating their children, if they are able to, from experiencing that inadequate food access.
One of the things that we did hear is that sometimes parents, families need to make choices. They have to make a choice between, should I buy food for my family, or should I pay rent, or should I pay for my utilities? And that did come up. One of the wonderful things in Minnesota this school year, is that all students receive free and reduced free meals, both breakfast and lunch. And so that's really helped go into a great deal in that food system and keeping children from being hungry.
That's excellent. Do they have things in place for summer food programs as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's summer feeding programs that are available throughout the state of Minnesota. Also, they'll get a summer EBT, which means that they will get $40 per student per month if they're receiving SNAP benefits on their SNAP card so that they can feed their children.
To help cover that summer period. That's great. So it sounds like what you're saying is you're hearing more not about maybe a parent not eating so their kid can eat, but more not paying for other things, not being able to pay for other things so that they can feed the family. Right. That's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, and I will
oh.
also add, you know, when we start hearing more about those conflicting payments in my work with older adults, and that wasn't highlighted as one of our major themes, but we often see competing with medical care. So whether that's prescriptions, whether that's going to the doctor or dentist, it really is a choice between receiving that needed care and being able to feed yourself. And then it gets even more complicated when we start talking about diet-related chronic disease, when the treatment really is healthier food and consuming more, you know, expensive food items. So, you know, I do think the emergency food system can be a really important place for addressing that specific need. The problem is always going to be, again, those healthier foods are more expensive. They're less available through donations. So we need to be creative and figure out ways to use the foods that are available, increase the nutritional content. And then again, I think really focusing on nutrition education, helping those shoppers prepare those foods in ways that fit with their health needs.
Yeah. Thank you. So another question asked, this listener says, I've led a food pantry for a college campus before. I struggle with getting buy-in from university leaders to provide support and funding for the pantry. Based on your experience, how do you get these leaders to take action?
That's a tough one. So, you know, I think you know, I'm a mixed method researcher, so for things like that, I generally go with a more qualitative approach. I think if you know, you already have a food pantry established, just talking to some of the students who are using it, getting their stories, really get painting that picture so you understand, you know, the struggles of getting food overall, how maybe, you know, colleges are not an environment where there's good access to food. And the economic situation of many students is quite bad, I think. So really capturing that information and then also discussing how the food pantry is really helping the students achieve socially, achieve academically. I mean, you know, you've probably heard educators say before that you can't learn on an empty stomach, but really kind of painting that picture with real people's experience would be the route I would go. I don't have any experience in that kind of college setting. But if I was trying to convince those leaders, that's one of the approaches I take. You could also look at some of the evidence. You know, there's really good reports on college food insecurity as a problem. There is research around the impact of some of these food assistance programs, including, you know, like I mentioned, learning from COVID, the expanded SNAP to students. That was really beneficial for a lot of students, but it also had a lot of challenges. So again, I think just learning from those from the past is really powerful.
Patrick, I really like that answer. You know, one of the things I think university leaders struggle with as they're looking at supporting food pantries is that they have to admit that there's hunger on campus. And that's a hard thing that's a hard sell. And so maybe by talking, having students present that information and share their experiences, they'll recognize that hunger on campus exists.
Yeah, thank you so much. That really helps for both of those questions. You talked about some of the concerns, more recent concerns with inflation. Did the older adults you talked with mention any strategies they've been using for managing inflation?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is changing dietary behaviors. So, you know, we're not buying we're not eating as much meat. We're skipping on some of those fresh vegetables. We're relying more on frozen and canned vegetables, which can be healthy, but again, you need to have kind of this baseline level of knowledge so you know you're picking the healthy canned option, the one without that added sodium. And you know, the beyond that, it is really kind of those classic food security coping behaviors, many of which aren't healthy. So relying on lower quality foods, skipping meals, just kind of engaging in behaviors that we really don't want to see people doing, especially when it comes to diet and health.
Well, I wanted to... Kelly, did you have anything to add? Sorry.
Just that we know that there's a stigma about older adults going to food shelves, and as Patrick mentioned earlier, and just reinforcing that because of inflation, they're going to places where there's food distributions and going to the food shelves, and so that's the key takeaway, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. I want to thank you for sharing your expertise with us and sharing the research that you have done. At this point, I can pass it back to Paul.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you to Patrick and Kelly for coming here and sharing with us all today. I've just a few quick reminders before we close today's session. Again, please complete the survey you'll receive when we end the session. Your feedback is greatly appreciated. Be on the lookout for an email with today's recording, handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check the upcoming webinar section of the website. Journal Club continues next Monday. And with that, I hope everyone has a good day and a good eclipse if that's happening near you. Thank you.